Okay, good. So welcome everyone on the ARIES Working Group call, morning edition. Reminder for everyone that the call is recorded. The recordings will be posted at the bottom of the page at the end of the call. Today within, on the agenda, we have a standard point regarding the work updates. Then we'll take a look on the intro into the chained credential. We briefly mentioned about that during last call. Daniel found hopefully some time, yeah, he is already on the call, found some time to introduce the topic briefly about what is going on within that topic and tell people about the specifics of the chain credentials for the future implementation. Then a short topic related with the possibility to communicate back to the user through the WebSockets and the communication channels between the connected but not online agents from the user. And then a short open discussions about the future of the ARIES toolbox and find out the expectation of the community about that specific project and where we can take it further on. Okay, good. So quick update from the work items which we have on the list. Do we have anyone who can provide us any input about the ARIES protocol test suite? Agent test harness. Steven, do you have any update on that side?
Yeah, so we continue to move forward with the test harness. The latest we've done is added a pile of documentation and improved the structure of the repo, making it easier to add back channels and versions of agents or agent frameworks, so you can have multiple versions of the same product tested in the same way. You can now mix and match starting tests or starting agents under different roles. The roles are now sort of formalized into an enterprise agent and a holder agent and a malicious agent. Those are the three we use right now. And continue work on expanding the test cases. So that's where we are right now.
Perfect. Thank you very much.
Robert, I'll just mention that there have been a couple of PRs submitted to the other test suite by Keith from IBM, and those were merged in the last couple days.
Okay, great. Thank you. Anything else for those? Good. ARIES shared? Indy? ARIES credential?
Not a lot of work is going on right now as far as I know in those. Andrew is, from our side anyway, Andrew is spending his time mostly on revocation and trying to move forward some of the revocation ideas. ARIES CAMS Vostok, which is the first I'd heard of it by that name, but it's sort of an initiative to move specific Indy wallet capabilities to a repo, and Andrew is also working on that. That's the other thing he's been looking at as well, is thinking about how to, you know, what kind of form, how can we make it pluggable, the different storage mechanisms, and but still basically retain what Indy wallet is capable of doing.
Right. And regarding the release of the VDR, near release 0.6, how near we are?
Again, not a lot of progress. It's basically, I think, ready to go, but yeah, still ongoing. We did, I think it was mentioned last week, just in case, a tail server was added based on Indy VDR. So again, more experience in using it. It worked really well and was very useful in that work. So able to use a tail server now.
Okay, perfect. Good, cloud agent?
Other than the tail server, that's about it. 5.0.5.1 is out on PyPI and there's some notes in there about what's in it.
Okay, Perfect. Framework implementation, go.
Ruby? Don't see anyone on the call, but they're, as noted here, out of band is where they've been really working and a pile on issue credentials. So lots of really interesting progress they're making there. One of the things we're working on with Cloud Agent Python is out of band as well. And to try to move so we can start testing and integrating with Aries Framework Go.
Great. Anyone for .NET? I know that there's a lot of happening there, so maybe I will try to reach directly to Mislav to get a little bit update about that. I don't know if Stephen, if you know anything about what is going on there, or Sam?
I don't know a lot of what's going on other than things keep moving forward. I know one of the things we're kind of interested in talking about is at some point is they're doing connectionless issue, which could be interesting. We're not sure. We also think if out of band happens, it becomes less of an issue. But right now without out of band and without being able to reuse it, connectionless issue sounds pretty good.
Okay, great.
I will mention that Tomislav is, they're not usually in our Aries working group meetings, but they are pretty active on the RocketJet channels. So,
yeah. I'll try for the next meeting. I will try to collect some feedback from their side, what is going on. So we'll be able to provide some input for the community. Okay, good. What else? Static agent Python? Is there anything going on there?
No updates.
No updates. Aries Toolbox, I think we will have some news or hopefully a short discussion at the end of the call about the toolbox itself and the future path for it. So maybe we can skip that.
One item I will mention is there's an open PR for some updates to the way connections are handled. I know that Matt from Kiva is taking a look at that to review that as well. I had a walkthrough of the toolbox with him yesterday.
Okay, perfect. JavaScript. Okay, reach schema. We have a Ken on the call? No. Aries mobile agent, Aries Max, and Ursa. Okay, good. So let's move on then to the main topics of the call. Daniel, would you like to share the screen or?
Sure. Give me just a second to figure out which tab. I've got like 500 tabs open. Okay. I got it. Okay. Yeah. Let me share screen real quick. So, okay. So, this RFC is the one that describes the topic called chained credentials. And it used to have a slightly different name. When I first wrote it, I think we were calling these delegatable credentials, but after the IIW last fall, there was some good feedback that the name was wrong. And there was also some important feedback from Sam Smith about that we were failing to generalize a problem fully. And I really liked what he said. And so this document has had a substantial update. If you've looked at RFC 104 in the past, but it's been a while, you might want to go back and look at it again because it's significantly improved. But anyway, let me kind of cover the general concept here. Let me just say this. Chained credentials are about situations where you have an initial issuer
who issues something that gives the next party some set of authority, and then that party can delegate a subset of authority, and that party can delegate. So delegation is one problem that this kind of credential solves, and that's the one we started from, is delegation. But there's some other problems that this kind of credential solves as well. And the other big kind of thing that I want to impress on everybody is this does not require us to change anything very significant about credentials. We don't have to have a different data model. We don't have to depart from W3C credentials. We don't have to have indie style credentials. We can do this with ordinary W3C credentials that have nothing to do with indie or Aries if we want. It's just a set of conventions about what particular pieces of data ought to be in a credentials schema and how to interpret those pieces of data. Okay. So all we would have to do to get these features, for the most part, is just adopt some conventions. Okay. Somebody's commenting. Let me be quiet. Go ahead and ask questions if you need to. Okay. So let me talk a little bit in this section of this thing about motivation. One of the things that Sam Smith pointed out to me that was an important aha, and I don't know that this has ever been publicly articulated on a community call, is that verifiable credentials are headed for a problem. And the problem is the same one that began to affect the certificate ecosystem a few years after it became a thing. For those of us who remember the web being popularized and suddenly everybody needing to have certificates, initially browser certificate authority lists were pretty short. You know, there were 4 or 5 or 10 certificate authorities. I remember that day. Now there's hundreds and hundreds of certificate authorities that are by default turned on in browsers. And there've been debates, some of them pretty bitter debates, among browser manufacturers about which certificate authorities they should trust by default. And the thing that we're trying to avoid is having everybody have to know this giant list of everybody that they have to trust, because that causes lots of problems. What we would like instead is to have everybody have a small list of things that they want to trust and still achieve very broad trust that's pervasive in an ecosystem. And there's a reason why chain credentials provide that. If you think about, let's say, a mom wanting to certify that a babysitter who has worked for her is a great babysitter, it's easy enough for that mom, in theory, to issue a credential, but it's quite hard for the world to know that they should trust that mom. And so this is the manifestation of that problem, is when everybody can be an issuer, you suddenly have the problem of knowing how many of those everybody's you want to trust as issuers, and there's not any good recipe for knowing how to do it. What we've said in the past is, the trust framework will tell you. And I think that's a true answer, but I don't think that it fully eliminates the problem. And so that's one of the reasons why we need this mechanism, because it decreases the chains of trust. If I go back to a picture like this one down here at the that has Thrift Bank, you can trust Alice, the CEO, the corporate counsel, Carl, and the staff attorney, Dell, because of how they're chained back to Thrift Bank, which is an entity you really actually do know about. And those chains allow trust to be rooted in simple ways, but to pervade the rest of the ecosystem by extension, without anybody being configured in advance about those extensions of the chain. So that's a lot of kind of theoretical words, but that's the motivation for this generally. Now,
Data provenance is an important thing that I also didn't get the first time I came at this topic. Delegating authority is really a specific variation on delegating or on tracking where data comes from. The particular data that you're tracking when you're doing delegation is where your authority data comes from. But the truth is that any data has a provenance, and that provenance could be interesting. So in the diagram that I'm showing here, you have a person who has a job with Acme, and Acme issues an employment credential, but Acme is authoritative about the hire date and the title of that person in the credential, but depends on a government issued credential to get the official name of the person they hired. So in the employment credential, the provenance of the name is actually a passport issued by the government, even though the credential from Acme contains that name. And if Acme says, "We got this name from a government passport," it probably adds more credence to their assertion that the name is Bob than if Acme just asserts it directly themselves. And that general phenomenon of citing your sources is something that we already believe in. Journalists cite their sources. People who write academic papers cite their sources. So why aren't we citing our sources in credentials? And could we cite our sources in credentials? Citing your sources for authority is the way that you get delegation. But you can cite your sources for things that aren't authority as well. The heart of the RFC is a specific delegation problem. And it talks about a company, Your Wheels, that's a national company that has a regional office in Houston, Texas, and then rents a car that they own to Alice, who in turn gives the car to a valet when she goes to the restaurant to park. And there's a delegation that has to happen there. Now, the heart of the conventions that I'm suggesting we adopt here include that there is an embedded schema inside the credential so that anybody who encounters the credential can compute against the schema without any external dependence. Like, they don't even have to go look up a hash link and find it on a website somewhere. It's literally inside the credential itself is a simple declaration of the schema it purports to implement. And then it contains a field called provenance proofs. And this field shows where data came from. If the data in question is authorization data, then what it's doing is delegation. If the data in question is citing sources for other data, then it may just show where the data came from in other fields. And this diagram here is just an example of how the delegation increases the provenance proof field's content with each link in a chain. The diagram needs to be updated because it labels this field delegation proof, and the text now says that this field should be labeled provenance proofs. Anyway, I'm not going to stop describing the mechanism here and just step back from this for a minute and just say all of this has been described now for about, in the latest incarnation of this document, it's been out for about 6 months. And I've been asked, so is this implemented yet? You could, without waiting for anybody anywhere else in an ecosystem, without waiting for indie support somewhere, you could actually follow the conventions described in this RFC today, which means you could issue chained credentials.
you could do that at any point in a chain. The two inhibitors to this delivering value are that verifiers would have to know about the conventions as well, or they wouldn't be following the chain back to something that they trust. So we'd have to update our verification logic. And the second thing is we need a better mechanism for revocation, because revocation today requires a complex issuer setup where tails files are managed, which would mean that every link in the chain here would have to go through that setup. So in the last 6 months, what's happened is revocation has been tackled, and we are near delivering value on revocation where the issuer setup is much more lightweight. And there is a clever way that parties downstream in a credential chain could cooperate with the root issuer to update revocation that has not been implemented. But the main thing that's stopping us from getting value out of this mechanism is a will to adopt it, and logic in verifier code that follows a chain back. And that I don't think is very hard logic. We would love to have somebody, you know, volunteer to implement it somewhere. I'm starting to get into code in Aries Indie VDR and places like that where I could potentially, you know, donate such a feature, but it's not currently on my to-do list. Robert, is that as much detail as you were hoping to get out of this update, or do you want more?
Definitely. I mean, obviously we could discuss in details on the specific stuff, but maybe anyone has any questions so far for this topic?
Yeah. So we're one of the people that are hoping to implement this chain credentials piece. And so I did have a couple of questions for Daniel. One of my questions was, with this setup, is it possible to go from one proof and create many credentials? That is to say, can the card title agency allow Alice to generate multiple copies of being able to issue the car? This wouldn't really work because the car is only one item, but say you were just delegating authority to issue a type of credential. Is that something that is possible?
Yes. Yeah, that's a minor adaptation. That wouldn't be very hard. We can talk about that offline, and maybe we should update the RFC to specifically describe how to do that. But I think that would be pretty easy.
Okay. Go ahead. I don't know. Someone else is saying something. The other question I had was these provenance proofs that you have described. Are these just a proof of owning the original credential? Is that all it is? Is it an unencrypted proof?
Well, it's essentially a direct embedding of a verifiable presentation that proves whatever you need to prove. So let's say that you're trying to prove that, I'll go back to the simple case here. You're trying to prove in the case of an employment credential that the name Bob came from a government passport. So what you would do with that provenance proof is in that field of your credential as ACME, you would say, here is the actual verifiable presentation we got from the government. We got it from Bob, but Bob used the government issued passport to give it to us. And so here's the exact bytes we got that constitute the proof that his name was Bob from a government credential. You take that and stick that in your credential, and now anybody who sees your credential says, you're asserting Bob. I'm going to go look at the provenance. Oh, the provenance is this other presentation, and they can verify that presentation as well. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so there's nothing special about it. It's just a verifiable presentation of the original credential.
Right, and that's why we don't need to, like, we're not recommending that anybody have to update the verifiable credential spec or do anything special. It's just a convention saying, if you got proof of something else upstream, just take that proof and embed it in this particular field in your credential so that everybody knows to go get it there.
Gotcha. And then finally, the verifier logic that you were talking about, is that just checking the presentation proofs? There's nothing I'm missing there, is there?
No, it's just walking the provenance back as far as you need to go till you hit something that you like.
Okay. Would that be custom for credentials? So would a verifier need to have that custom logic for type of credential that they're trying to check? Is this something that can be implemented generically for verification?
I think it's generic, right? It's just a recursive process. And you just follow the recursion until you hit something that your trust framework tells you you should have trusted to begin with.
Okay, cool. We're very excited for this. I mean, when I first saw this, I was like, this is one of the key things that we can be implementing. So I'll connect with you offline and we'll see where we can go from there.
Okay.
Daniel, I have questions. So first is just a mental verification. With certificates for web servers, they have a certificate chain. So if you end up with a certificate that isn't issued by one of the blessed ones in the browser, you have to provide a certificate for them, right, that links eventually back to one that is blessed. So this is a similar concept, except instead of just doing the whole credential as it is, you can follow this up in a attribute type manner so that you can actually prove the provenance or the chain for individual attributes in a really flexible way. Is the mental model correct there?
Yeah. And by the way, I want to give credit. The first person that I ever heard describe this generally was Stephen Curran, and he did some of the early work that wrote this down too. So this is all, well, the good parts anyway come from Stephen, and the mistakes are probably my own.
Okay, so then a question. A presentation typically involves like a nonce so that you can make sure the presentation was prepared for you.
Right.
In the case of a chain here, there's several different steps, perhaps from different people, of actually providing this. How does the nonce play a role in the presentation when it's like multi-steps and parties deep?
Yeah, so this is really a good subtlety to bring up. You could compare the verifier of a chain to somebody who is like an auditor in one way. They're like an auditor, but they're unlike an auditor too. So let me describe first how they're like an auditor, and then I'll describe the subtlety where they're different. An auditor, let's say that a bank is trying to prove that they did KYC on a person using verifiable credentials. The bank will have saved off in some kind of an archive somewhere, the interaction that they had with Fred, where they challenged him to prove that he was, he lived at a particular place and had a government passport. And that will include a transcript that shows the challenge with the nonce and then the response that is a presentation that included that nonce. So an auditor looking at this evidence later is going to say to themselves, okay, I can tell that at the time they responded to the nonce, but that's not the same as somebody being able to prove to me in real time that they are Bob. I can see that in the past somebody proved that they were Bob. So there's no new nonce presented to the auditor. The auditor's just looking at the old one.
So it's more of like a historical provenance than an active one. I'm not sure those are the right words.
Right. Now here's the subtlety. What you want to do as a verifier is you want to be an auditor, but then for every chain link that you're looking at, you need to say, okay, I believe this happened in the past, namely, you know, you got delegated authority in the past, or, you know, you got Bob's name off the passport in the past or whatever. The extra question that you ask as a verifier of a chained credential is, has this has the credential that was the basis of this credential, too many words here. Has the credential that was the basis of this presentation I'm currently evaluating been revoked since the presentation was done? And so you have to do a liveness check on revocation, and that makes you different from an ordinary auditor. It doesn't give you a new nonce, but the liveness check on revocation updates or freshens the link, if that makes any sense.
Yep, that does. Thanks.
So Daniel, this is great. This is really cool technology. I do have a question. Have you, as you're looking back through these credential provenance chains, when you look at the example of Alice and the car and all that, and you can walk back who owns the car and how it got delegated, that's a great use case. It's very important. What I'm wondering about is, as we start to create these delegated credentials, are there privacy problems? Meaning, if I want to pay allow my babysitter to buy something for my children while she's babysitting or whatever, do I end up disclosing my citizenship and my employer and all sorts of things that I'd rather not to disclose? Right now, when I purchase things on eBay, I don't have to do that. But if I get into these situations, is somebody going to ask to walk back and validate my credentials such that to purchase online, I'm required to prove all of this private information about myself simply by the fact of walking back through the chain?
Yeah, that's a really important question. And one that I've thought about deeply. The fact that what you're embedding in this provenance proof field is just a verifiable presentation means that whatever selective disclosure choice you made when you provided that upstream data is it continues to be embodied. So if all that Bob does, going back to my example at the top here, if all that Bob discloses in his verifiable presentation is his first name, Bob, from his passport, then later in a chain, nobody can say, well, what was Bob's birth date from the passport? 'Cause it's not there. So selective disclosure is frozen at the time of embedding, if that makes any sense. Now, that's mostly good, but it could be bad if you disclosed a lot upstream in a data provenance chain. Whatever you disclosed upstream will be visible downstream as well. So you need to make choices that are limited to your intentions. You wouldn't want to disclose a lot in something that could become a chained credential if all you need to disclose is a very minor detail. Having said that, the other aspect of privacy here is, how are parties in a chain private from one another? So, you know, how much does UR Wheels find out about Alice's and the valet's behavior downstream? And how much does the valet or Alice find out about UR Wheels upstream? And the answer to that question is that there's two ways to handle, there's a section about this in the RFC. There's two ways to do this, and one gives more privacy to intermediate parties in the chain from each other the other discloses to downstream parties in the chain, everybody who's an upstream. You don't know like everything about them, but you know who the upstream parties are in a more significant way. But none of them disclose, like the upstream party, URWheels, doesn't know anything about what's happening with Alice and with a valet ever. It's only the other direction that there's a privacy consideration.
So let me kind of expand my question just a tad. So right now what happens in the industry is I'll take my email address and I'll use that as a login identifier at a wide range of sites, ranging from, you know, eBay to the federal government when I file my taxes to everything, right?
Right.
And so what's happened is that identifier has been co-opted by data collectors and data aggregators, that they don't just worry about what I disclosed to eBay. They correlate it with Amazon and everything else.
Right.
And so it's not just the single disclosure, but a compilation of multiple disclosures that ends up outing all sorts of information I'm trying to protect.
Right.
And so with something like this, if I rent the car, there's obvious things that I'd want to disclose. If I hire my babysitter and I want to enable her to take my kids to the hospital if such a need arises while I'm out, if data aggregators get a hold of multiple of these endpoints, can they walk them all back and create the big dossier that we're trying to avoid with zero knowledge?
The answer is yes and no, exactly to the same extent as a direct unchained verifiable presentation. So there's nothing about the chaining that makes that problem worse or better. If you give a credential to a babysitter saying, this babysitter is authorized to take my children to the hospital, what you put into that credential about yourself can be correlated, and what you leave out can't be correlated. So if you say, my name is Sally Smith and I live at the following address, and this is my social security number, and this is my birth date, and I hereby authorize the babysitter to do stuff, then yes, whenever the babysitter shares her credential, if her credential is carrying that, and if she doesn't use ZKP options and selective disclosure, but rather discloses everything that her credential holds, then you have exposed yourself to correlation. If, on the other hand, you say, I'm going to prove in zero knowledge that I'm the mother of a child named, Letitia Smith, and that's all I'm going to prove. You don't need to know anything else about me, and I hereby give my babysitter rights to take Letitia to the doctor's office, then the babysitter doesn't have the risk of exposing more than you wanted about you. Did that make sense?
No, that does. That does. I guess what I'm looking at is cross correlations. Let me just give this one example, and then I won't hold up the overall meeting. But let's say, for example, Letitia in this case goes to the doctor's office or the store or whatever. They're going to ask for this credential, and she's going to give that whatever proof is required based on what she's been delegated. And there may be something that could then cross-correlate. Like, it might have some new information that hadn't been used in separate delegation chains, but there might be some cross-correlating fiducial points between what I use for the rental car agency or purchasing on Amazon or with my babysitter, that what happens today, it's places like Walmart where they and Amazon, where they collect all this information, they provide it into a big pool, and these data aggregators start putting things together from multiple transactions. That's kind of a concern that I'm having here. And I'd be happy to talk about this offline, but I love the example of the rental car. I'm just wondering about, as we do this multiple times, are we going to end up making it easier on the data aggregators than it is today?
That's a really good question. Let's talk offline, Steve, and maybe we should add a section to this RFC about cross-correlation with multiple uses. I think, I think I'm now understanding your articulation of a risk a little differently than I did the first time you asked it, and there might be something there. So let's talk later.
Sounds good. Thank you.
One more question from my side. I don't know if that was what you just explained and the possibilities here, but I'm just wondering, is it possible that in this example that the UR Wheels National, that they can verify the credential which was issued by, I forgot the name of the lady in the third step, but the credential which was issued there without knowing that actually it was issued by her, means that, is it possible to verify the last credential in the C3 without knowing the whole path back to, knowing by name the entities which actually issue it, by just knowing that the root is me, right? That it came from me, but I don't want to know the whole path back to me.
Well, the verification process will eventually get back to you, but everybody in between the leaf and the root is effectively anonymous. You don't need to know anything about them. You don't need to know how many steps removed you are, and you don't need to know what the names of any of these parties are. UR Wheels could basically demand that the valet prove something and walk the chain back and get back to themselves and say, oh, yep, sure enough, this is a valid thing. Does that answer your question, or am I not understanding it?
No, that's the correct thing. It means that if the entities through the chain, if they can be anonymized in a way that I have no way to figure it out, what was her name or which entity actually issued the last credential.
Right.
So if that's possible, then yeah, perfect. Okay, good.
Daniel, can I ask you a question? Just following up on this. On anonymization of, I'll call it these intermediate parties, do you have use cases where, we just discussed the use case where in a sense you'd say this verifier is anonymous for this use case. Don't we also have use cases where that verifier needs to not be anonymous? Have you looked at both sets of use cases?
So
both might be supported. They're different use cases, obviously, for the same chain.
Yeah, so there's kind of early anonymity and late anonymity is a way to say it. And just to tweak your terminology, I think it's the holder that you're asking about anonymity for, the party who actually holds the credential, or the party that issued something upstream that resulted in the credential they're holding. But the verifier isn't the one that we're trying to make anonymous here, I think. The verifier is the party that's demanding proof.
Oh, sorry, I apologize. I didn't mean the verifier.
Let me just give a concrete example of early and late anonymity really quick. Let's take Alice, who's the third party in this four-party chain. Alice has a credential issued by UR Wheels Houston that says, Alice rented a car from us and she's authorized to drive it. And I'm going to guess that UR Wheels Houston's credential, this is credential C2, that's right in the middle of the diagram between UR Wheels and Alice, that credential probably identifies Alice strongly. Okay, it probably has her name, her phone number, her, you know, driver's license number, all these other things. Now, Alice, when she issues credential C3, giving the authority to a valet to drive this car on her behalf, she has the choice. She can carry forward the strongly identifying information about herself such that credential C3 contains her name, her phone number, and her driver's license number, or she can choose to be anonymous early. And anonymous early would be that Alice just proves in zero knowledge that she has the right to drive the car and delegate to a valet. Nothing else. You don't know what her name is. You don't know her driver's license. You don't know her birth date. You don't know what state she lives in. Nothing other than she's an authorized driver of the car. And if that's what she chooses, then the credential held by the valet has already made Alice anonymous. The valet cannot un-anonymize Alice, so to speak. And anybody downstream from the valet can never find out about Alice either. If she chooses to be late anonymous, what she does is she puts all of that information in credential C3, but tells the valet, hey, I'm willing to let you know, but I would prefer that you not disclose this to anybody. And that's risky. And it's not guaranteed, but there might be circumstances where she could do that. And so I think you can see that different use cases would call for being either early anonymous or late anonymous. If you choose early, you give up the ability to strongly identify Alice downstream in the chain from then on.
Yeah, so if you, following this example, there's a record back at UR Wheels in Houston that Alice did rent a vehicle, right?
Right.
And that record would be detailed in theory on her identity, right?
Right.
So then the question comes down to, there are use cases for UR Wheels in Houston where you want to know information about the rental, but you don't need information about Alice in detail.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
And so a lot of those use cases I think are controllable on the data side, right? So the problem is you have to separate, in a sense, logical data that's visible versus data that's not, you know, based on use case.
Yes.
So as an example, if there's an if I'm the manager in Houston and there's an accident and I've got to, you know, whatever, notify Alice's relatives, you've got to go pick her up somewhere. That's a use case that says, oh, you really want to strongly identify Alice as the renter. But on the other hand, if I'm trying to say, oh, look, you know, how long do our vehicles, you know, stay out on the road or how many miles on average? That's a case where I don't need to strongly identify Alice, right?
Right.
And so there's this concept of profiling based on use case. What information should be available based on use case at UR Wheels in Houston is my argument.
Yeah, I agree with you.
And there ought to be a way to automate, in a sense, the availability of the information for a use case. So even though, to your point, we have strongly identified Alice correctly at UR Wheels in Houston, we should be able to, in a sense, manage the access to that information based on use case differently. And there ought to be a way to automate that somehow.
Well, the general precept of SSI would say, you give Alice whatever information you have about her that, you know, makes sense. And then Alice can filter out using selective disclosure whatever is appropriate in particular circumstances that she finds herself in. But Alice can't influence anymore what you know about her because she's already given it to you. So the place to make choices is in Alice's use of her credentials. There's not really a credential place to make choices at UR Wheels. It's a non-credential place. Like, UR Wheels can say that in part of its system,
its customers are strongly identified, and in part they're not, but those aren't verifiable credential choices anymore. Those are just data choices.
Yes, to fit use cases. I agree with that. Good point. Thanks.
Okay, great. Thank you very much, Daniel, for the presentation and the insight into the chain credentials. I hope that everyone liked it, and soon we'll see the implementation of that great technology. Before we'll shut up, because we still have around 5 minutes, so the topic about communication back to the user, we'll skip and put another call. But this what I would like to jump into is the short discussion about the Aries toolbox and see basically what the community thinks about the feature of the Aries toolbox and how you guys are using it. And maybe Sam, if you could give a brief intro about the current, or let's say the assumption of the Aries toolbox, and then we can just go through feedback from the people on the call, what they think about and how they are using the Aries toolbox at the moment. And then maybe we can shortly discuss about where we should take the Aries toolbox in the next steps.
Robert, I can. Further, we actually have some time on the call later this afternoon. If you wanted to pick up either of those topics and have them today rather than wait for another 2 weeks, I don't know how far we'll get. So let me start because I'm also really interested in the WebSocket topic. So, but we have too much goodness that we're trying to cram into one call. the original idea behind the Aries toolbox, and I'm hedging my words intentionally here. There's been more interest with different ideas, and I'm open to this. The toolbox did originate with some ideas that I had, but I don't need to control what it is, right? So I'm hedging my words a little bit with what it was originally, and to give it freedom to be whatever it needs to be in the future. The very core original idea was that interacting with an agent is sometimes painful. If you're developing an agent and you want to be able to interact with it, it's hard to build both sides sometimes at the same time. And in the web world, we often use tools like Postman in order to mock up messages or requests or interact with the software on the other side. If I'm writing a web server, I can interact with the web server, using sort of a tool that doesn't require any programming, but just a little bit of configuration. And then I can interact with it to have it, talk back and forth. And so that was one of the original ideas. And there is in the toolbox the ability to compose a message and send it to the agent on the other side. And the cool part about that is that if you're developing, message handlers and an agent, then you can craft a message the way you want it and send it across. It functions that way as a development tool. There's also a message history, for example, that lets you see messages back and forth and can help you discover and sort of inspect the messages back and forth. It became obvious too that some of those same features that developers find useful would also be useful by a system administrator. For example, there's a handful of tasks that could be automated really well. So the model has been picked up in several places where you have a controller that interacts with the agent code base, and the decisions about what to do are actually done over in the controller, and then that's implemented and actually made real, if you will, inside of the agent code. So Akamai does this, and I believe that the Go code base is similar there. But there's some operations that aren't really worth scripting because they happen so infrequently. The idea was that the toolbox could provide an easy way to do those sorts of things, either for demo purposes or for configuration of an agent type purposes. So one of those things might be to either create or load a previously created schema and tell the agent that that's one you want to use. That would be something that you're not going to do hundreds of thousands of times. You may do it more than once, right? But it's probably on the lower end. These types of things we could automate or make easy for people that are setting up and managing agents sort of from the get-go. So that was the original idea behind the toolbox. It's created, the code base was originally designed as an Electron app, and it can still be built that way. There's been another effort to take at least a portion of it and just serve it up as a regular web property application, which has some really cool uses as well. It is designed in a way that allows the creation of what I call a UI module. And a UI module is a chunk of interface that then corresponds with one or more protocols on the back end. And then the toolbox interface dynamically adjusts what is shown depending on the supported protocols using the Discover Features protocol. And that way, when you see the toolbox, you only see the interfaces that are actually supported by the agent that you connected to. So that's a bit of a quick summary. Is that what you're looking for?
That was brilliant. Yes. So one thing which I will add from my side is that this is how we started using the Ares toolbox, is that mostly within the sandbox environments to let people play with the technology, which is basically the agent. So we call it TDA, which expands a little bit in the context of the functionality. So you can think of it like extra plugins to the agents to do some extra things, which is much more valuable within the decentralized data economy and not only dealing with the identity, right? So we are kind of on the edge with the data semantics and things like that, right? And it's super useful to have a very simple UI, which actually you can play with those stuff to understand the technology, to, as you said, administration stuff, maintenance, and do a simple kind of postman thing that you can click it through and it works, right? So that's how we started using it. And obviously from our side, we would love to contribute with that, what we are building, to extend those features, to make it much more generic for the purposes of not only talking with the agent, but letting the agents to talk to other agents and do this kind of designing those flows so you can create this interaction without the need for having a digital wallet in the place, in the sense of having a production UI system on top of the agent. So maybe a quick question to everyone on the call. How many of you are using Ares Toolbox daily, or at least for the projects which you are working with? Raise your hand. Okay, not many.
I know that Kiva is. I know that Kiva is, and they're not here to raise their hand.
Exactly, yeah. Because basically this is what we would love to figure it out, is that what are the expectations of the community from that tool? Because I know that a lot of people are using Ares Toolbox in a slightly different ways. And obviously getting a feedback from the community will be helpful to figure it out in which direction we can take it. Because as I understood right now, Sam, you mentioned that basically you're looking for the maintainers of the project. And you're looking for the kind of support in the taking the Ares to the, let's say, next level and continue developing it. Is that
correct? Yes, I did. And two have reached out. You, Robert, reached out and Matt at Kiva. And I yesterday I walked him through. They're beginning to use the toolbox more. And so he was interested in helping with that. So, we are getting out of time, but I'm very happy to continue this conversation on this afternoon's call. I think it would be really useful. Yep. To sort of figure out, and perhaps further calls are done outside of the main call. But I think as sort of an original one, that would be really nice. And it may be useful to do a quick demo, and I can do that as well. Just to help orient people with what it is and such.
Definitely. Okay, good. Then let's close this one here. Let's continue the discussion on the next call. And thank you very much, everyone, for taking your time to join us. And have a nice evening, day, and so on. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Thanks, Robert.